Let's call this meeting to order. I think we have a quorum. No, don't have one yet. We're waiting for, how many more? Two more. Representative Hackbarth, why don't you come to the table? We'll get your bill going. I will move House File 3711 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
Thank you, members. Good morning. This bill was brought to me originally a complaint by a constituent. He owns a gas station in my district, and a couple of years ago I passed a bill on fuel vapor recovery, and I put
that
equipment on fuel tankers and at the gas pump, or not at the gas pump, at the when you fill your tanks at the gas station, some equipment that recovers fuel vapor. And through the petrol fund, we had a reimbursement program, and that expired January of 2006. Well, there were a number of folks that didn't know about the program or didn't hear about the program, and also tried to get equipment to do this, and they had kind of a backlog of equipment, and they couldn't get their equipment out to the station to install it. So all we're really asking here, members, is an extension on that for the reimbursement program to extend it out to September of 06, just an eight-month extension, so people can be reimbursed for this very good program that we put in place. That's really the extent of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions from the members? Representative Mahoney.
Now, this program has, Mr. Chair and Representative Hackbarth, this program has been in existence for how long?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, 3 years it's been in existence now.
You know, Mr. Chair, and we always thought all those oil people were so up to date and smart and right on top of everything.
Actually, I think it was.
Can we get a
in place?
Can we get retroactive on our the price of gasoline in 3 years? No, never mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
I think I know the answer to this, but can you use LCMR money for this?
Representative Hackbarth probably knows more about that than I do.
I don't know, but I don't care if you do use LCMR money for it. But no, this is a petrol fund. It's a separate fund that's already been set up and collected for. You can have
Chairman
explain the petrol fund if you'd like.
No, that's fine. My point was just, this seems like a better environmental use of the LCMR than paving over trails.
I'm with you.
That we usually see with LCMR. You know, it's set up for the environment, and it's usually paving over nature.
I think the governor's working on that deal. Representative Nelson.
A little more serious note.
I was serious.
Do we know how many you're talking about stations or that this much money's going to do? And are we going to be coming back at a later date for the next group of people that, oops, I missed?
Mr. Chairman, from what I understand, there's about 50 or 60 stations that haven't completed this yet, or haven't been reimbursed.
Thank you.
I think everybody knows about it now, and they've got their equipment, and they're just waiting for reimbursement now.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, put it this way, maybe the petroleum industry, maybe they could come to the table and explain to us how they're going to ensure that everybody knows. Be nice to know, though, that that they're actually doing something to inform these people other than just relying on government.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbarth.
Chairman, Representative Mahoney, they did notify the folks. They sent out newsletters and notified folks a number of times. I think some of the folks at the gas stations didn't read their newsletters and kind of missed the boat.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Remember last night in Commerce when somebody asked me if I wanted to comment, and I said nope.
Yeah, I remember.
That might have been a good idea.
I thought that was a very appropriate response, by the way. Any other questions? With that, I will renew my motion to have... I hear the motion.
Yep.
Have House File 3711 laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
We have a quorum now. We'll officially call this meeting to order, by the way. Okay, Representative Finstead.
He's got an amendment.
Is he? Does he have to move that one?
You have an amendment on your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the DE1 amendment.
Representative Wilkin, you want to move this bill, please?
Sure, I'll move it.
Bill is moved.
3360.
For this bill goes to the floor, is that correct?
Correct.
You understand?
General Register, yes.
So, Representative Wilkins moves House File 3368 to pass and go to the floor. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little slow this morning. Did you just move the DE1 amendment?
No,
okay.
Just the bill. You can I'll move your DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to describe your amendment?
The DE1, Mr. Chair, the DE1 amendment is to get the bill in the shape that we're prepared to testify. It's a very quick technical bill that just clarifies, or amendment that clarifies some language that was passed last year in the DHS licensing bill dealing with child passenger restraint systems and training. It just clarifies what training for what type of vehicle. And I have Chad... Dunkley, correct? Chad Dunkley with me to talk a little bit more in detail about the exact purpose of the DE1 amendment.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Dunkley. I'm president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. And we've lived with this bill for a year, and we've come to... The bill was originally intended to teach providers about appropriate passenger restraints, particularly for infants and toddlers and car seats and other. We're only asking to have those providers who only transport school-age children in school buses, where those types of passenger restraints aren't necessary, to be excluded from this training, so we can focus those training resources on things that do apply to them. So it's a very small exception just for those who transport school-age children in school buses.
Mr. Dunkley, do you know the reason why child restraints aren't required in buses?
You know, I've been on the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration website, and they conclude that school buses are so safe for children that actually seatbelts may not be worth it. But in our buses, we do have seatbelts. We have lap belts because they do provide extra safety, and those are required of the smaller buses that we're using.
Okay. Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dunkley, I'm just wondering why, I suppose if you're using a school bus, it's most likely a child care center, but I'm thinking of some of the in-home child care that might have one of the small school bus type things too. Is there a reason why we need to say child care centers? Can we say child care providers? Because we're accomplishing the same thing. We're focusing on what the vehicle is rather than who the provider is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, we'd certainly be comfortable with that. This language was actually a compromise with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Public Safety, and I believe that language was a recommendation through the Department of Human Services, but we'd certainly be comfortable with that. It's the same vehicle and the same safety for children.
Maybe it come down.
Does anyone from Human Services have any objection to that?
You seem to make it less clear by going back 9 years later.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm from Department of Human Services in the Licensing Division. And to Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, that amendment probably wouldn't have much effect in that family child care providers, as you know, tend to care for a wide range of kids, from infants up through school-age kids. And, you know, a single provider can have 10 kids, and two adults can have up to 14 kids. But they tend to be a big mix of kids. What this very limited exception is if you're transporting only school-age kids in a school bus. So it's probably not going to be the case where a family child care provider has a school bus, to transport a couple of school-age kids.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Kerber, it wouldn't do any harm, though, would it, in case there are some of those? Because what I don't like is when we continually discriminate against one type of provider over another. So if we do no harm, I'm going to move an oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Wilkin. The only harm is that this is a decrease in the safety standards that were pursued last year. In general, we were looking for additional training for all providers on how to properly restrain kids. So this is scaling it back a little bit, and it's possibly scaling it back just a little bit more. But is it going to have a significant impact, the amendment? I don't think it would.
Okay. Well, then I'll move, Mr. Chairman, on line 2.1. that the word centers be deleted and replaced with providers.
Pretty well, Ms. Long, you got that where you want it? Pretty easy one, isn't it? Does everybody understand the oral amendment on line 2.1? Delete centers and add providers, is that correct?
That's correct.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendments carried. We have to pass a D, your amendment. Now, the H3368DE1 amendment is before us. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As amended. Hold the same sign. Motion carries. The bill is the way you like it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Representative Vincent, looking at the delete all amendment and looking at the bill, in the bill you've got you've deleted children under 9 years of age. Now, did you replace that and put that back in the delete all, so that children under the age of 9 or school age? I just want to be clear, because in the original bill where you deleted under 9 years of age and put in school age, that would tend to cause more confusion, I would bet, rather than clear anything up. I just want to make sure that you're not creating more confusion for people.
Mr. Chair, I've just been informed that on page 2, line 2, 245A.02 is the section of law that refers to the school age, and it does, we did not change that. It's my understanding in this delete all amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the understanding is that section of law 245A.02 refers to under the age of 9, so that we're not creating more confusion. And if we do that, a little more checking and find that at between now and the floor, if the department and the providers and everybody's okay with an age limit or some understanding, I just don't want to create some confusion. So, no offense to the attorneys in the world, but wherever there's confusion, there's money for an attorney and cost to the state, and all I'm trying to do is make sure it's clear.
Mr. Kerber, I think, has something to add.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, the wording here provides quite a significant amount of precision, actually, because the bill says, the current law says in general that if you're serving kids under age 9, you have to have this training. This new paragraph E is an exception to that, so that if you're transporting only school-age kids in a child care, then you don't, in a school bus, then you don't have to. And school age is defined in that reference, and it's essentially that if the child is going to be ready for admission to kindergarten within the next 4 months. So if you do the math, it's sort of like 4 years and 8 months old. And so that is a definition that gets referred to by child care centers on a regular basis for defining age groupings of kids. So school-age child is a very used definition. I think Mr. Dunkley would probably concur with that.
That's fine. I mean, just like I said, I'm just trying to make sure that everybody understands that there's a clear, defined line that And if it's 4 years, 8 months, I don't care. I just don't want somebody yelling at me, how come you weren't smarter?
Nobody yells at you, do they?
No more than
you. Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, what happens when you have mixed groups of kids? Because often, especially for after-school programs, I mean, you might have either a mixed group or maybe that doesn't happen on some of these buses. And then what about, as far as child restraint, so you're limiting it down to from 9 to 5, but what for car seats, and what is the age limit on car seats and booster seats and all of that?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawik, this is an area where there's a slight inconsistency between the seatbelt law and what the training requirements are for licensed programs, and that's we understand that. Under the seatbelt law, people are required to use a child restraint system up through age 4, is my understanding. There have been attempts over the years to raise that based on the age and height of the child to age, you know, through age 8 and up to 80 pounds and some, I can't remember the height, but based on the National Highway Traffic Safety Standards, if you go to the training, it's going to be recommended to you that you use a booster seat up through age 8, essentially. And so the effort of the department last year was to simply say that people who are transporting kids under age 9 should have that training, so they at least know how to do it according to the recommendations of the National Highway Traffic Safety Commission. But and the recommendations are a little higher than what's currently in state law. And so this bill sort of brings the expectation for child care centers and now family child care providers as well more consistent with the state law for transporting kids.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawik, can I respond to that in addition? Where that does not match is the fact that when we're on a school bus, I have information from the National Highway Safety Transportation Administration. You are using lap belts, and you are not to have a booster seat when you're only using lap belts. It's only when you're using shoulder harnesses because they're designed for adults. And so I actually brought that information. And so we're only asking for the limitation when they're on school buses that, you know, are equipped with lap belts that are designed for children. So actually, it is not recommended by them that those particular types of vehicles, you do use booster seats up to 8. Certainly, as a provider, I would never want to jeopardize the safety of children. And the only reason we're asking for this is our staff are sitting in a class that doesn't apply to the work they do. I, as a provider, do much more training in safety of transportation than this. My insurance company requires it, first of all, but I actually do a ride-along with a safety director who sits in a vehicle and teaches about appropriate safety on the road. A lot of other key components that are important with safety. But this particular training, the staff are sitting through it, and it doesn't apply to the particular vehicle they're using in a particular age group of child. But I do have that, and I will give that to you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, Representative Wilkin renews his motion to have House File 3368 as amended to pass and go to the floor. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Satterstrom. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will move House File 3597 and recommend it. No, we'll move it to civil law, I believe. Is that correct? Well, you understand?
Yes, that's correct.
I think that's appropriate motion. Tell us about your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am State Representative Judy Soderstrom, representing District 8B. Mr. Chairman, members, House File 3597 is a bill which would extend the amount of time that a mother has to give up the custody of her child under a law which is called Safe Havens. And this law was first passed in 2000. And the Safe Havens law allows a mother 72 hours to bring her newborn child to a hospital anonymously. and the hospital will provide any necessary medical care and then notify the Department of Human Services, which will then assume custody of the child. My bill extends the time up to 7 days and allows for a hospital to receive a newborn who was born at the hospital if that's the mother's wish. The hospital would then be prohibited from disclosing the mother's identity. The bill as proposed would also allow a parent to call 911 or an emergency service provider and request a law enforcement officer or emergency medical personnel to meet them and then receive custody of the child. Under current law, mothers who use safe havens are protected from child abandonment charges unless the baby is harmed. So the hospital or safe haven will accept the child, will not turn away a child that's harmed, but then the mother does lose her identity protections under this bill. As of June 2005, 46 states have some sort of safe haven law with varying times and frames acceptable for the drop-offs. Strict identity protections make it difficult to track the number of times that this law has actually been used. But in 2003, the National Conference of State Legislatures estimated that 33 babies had been legally relinquished under the laws, and two of those were in Minnesota. Now, that was in 2003. But they don't, because we want this to be anonymous, they're not. We're not tracking them. And I became aware of this law late last April when one of my constituents contacted me and wondered why our law in Minnesota stated that a baby could only be dropped off at a hospital if it was only no more than 72 hours old. And she stated that she'd done some research, and Iowa gives the mother 2 weeks, and South Dakota, a child can be dropped off until 2 months of age, and in North Dakota, a child can be dropped off until 1 year of age. Year of age. So we all wish mothers, of course, would choose to keep and raise their children, but if they have a secret pregnancy and feel isolated, we want them to have this extra time because it might make the difference between placing a child in safe hands or doing something very tragic. So, Mr. Chairman, members, I encourage you to vote yes on this important legislation.
Representative Solomon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Soderstrom, there's just one part I have a question on, which page 3, that's the part about line 23, a search for the mother or relatives must not be conducted for an infant. Then it goes on to say, not only is the agency not required to, but that's crossed out, and they must not search for relatives. You know, most thinking around child welfare laws are to keep families together, you know, even when there's a difficult situation. And that's all the precursor of most of the things in family law. So in this case, they're not allowed, the relatives, it's not that they necessarily have a claim, but I'm sure there might be some relatives interested in helping out with that child. So they're prohibited from doing that?
Thank you, Representative, and Mr. Chairman. The reason for the law was that, I think Texas was the first state that enacted this type of legislation, and they had found, I think they had 3 babies that were in dumpsters or something like that. So this is a way for somebody to that doesn't want a child to take it someplace and somebody will care for it. And the reason also for making a few changes in the that you can't conduct a search for the family is that, I guess, in Minnesota there was a girl that did give up her baby, and then social services called all her relatives, and that defeated what we were trying to do with this bill. So the child is then put up for adoption.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Solly.
Thank you, Representative Soderstrom. Is the family eligible, or can they apply through the adoption process if they... Do you have any idea how that works?
Representative Soderstrom.
It is my understanding, Mr. Chairman and Representative, it's my understanding that they do post abandoned babies. There is some notification in the newspaper that there is an abandoned child, but my understanding is no one has ever come forward to try to claim that child. So they do some posting in the paper. So I suppose if you knew somebody was pregnant and realized they probably had a child, you could maybe check that out. And for somebody to claim that child, then it would have to be some type of a DNA or blood test.
And that would, Mr. Chair, And that if he established the DNA and through the blood test that there's some genetic correlation, then that would all kick into all that set of laws, I suppose.
Yes.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sostrom, on page 2, lines 2.1 to 2.4, calling 911 is supposed to be really reserved for emergency kinds of things, and this could imply sending an expensive emergency vehicle or something. I'm not sure what the function of this is. I mean, certainly we don't need to write into law if you want to call emergency service, you want to call a hospital or something like that. But particularly to suggest to someone that in all cases of this, that you call 911 seems to rise to a standard that we would not want people routinely to be using 911.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, this isn't used often. I mean, it might be one or two or three times. And what's saying is that some small towns don't have a hospital. So in the past, you had to take this child to a hospital. And what we felt is that if they wanted to be anonymous, they wouldn't necessarily make the call and be at their home. They could meet them at a filling station or someplace else, and just all they have to do is hand the baby over. And we're trying to protect a child or a baby that somebody doesn't want. So that was the reason for that. And Wisconsin has this in their legislation, and that's where we found out about this idea. The other thing is that the way the other legislation was written, you couldn't have a baby in the hospital and be allowed to use the safe haven and be anonymous. But we did add that on page 1, lines 22, 23, and 24, a mother could have the baby in a hospital and still choose to just say, you know, I don't want this baby, and anonymously give it up. And the hospital has to not disclose the identity of the mother.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly follow up. I realize that it says may, but then it says the person receiving the call shall send, so it's pretty prescriptive in terms of the response to that. And I'm trying to figure out. I understand accommodating, but I'm not sure that I understand why we need to put that kind of prescriptive language in it. People can use whatever resources are necessary to find somebody, but there's lots of kinds of ways that somebody might not necessarily be a law enforcement or emergency medical personnel. It might be a social worker or somebody else that could be engaged, because those kinds of things typically mean a fairly expensive approach to making contact, and it seems like it could be a lot less expensive.
Any comment on that?
Well, thank you.
Maybe I can suggest you make the other one may, too.
Oh, so which?
On page 2.
Making that a motion.
Page 2, line 2.2, is that right, Representative Bradley?
That'd be right. That would make it just a little bit more options, so change that shall to may on 2.2.
Would you like to make
that
oral amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Well,
with all due respect, may, then you don't need the paragraph, because they may do it now.
Well, that's what I said in the first place.
Yeah.
But, Mr. Chair, my point would be that I don't know that it necessarily has to be a law enforcement officer, emergency personnel. It could be as simple as a social worker or something like that. There's lots of kinds of ways, but the minute that we say that it has to be a law enforcement emergency, now, I know you're making maybe a big deal out of something that probably is not going to be a problem, but I'd feel more comfortable just to change it to me. So I wouldn't move the amendment on line 2.2 to change shall to me.
Representative Wilkin.
Chairman, I'd have to speak against my good friend Representative Bradley's motion, because I think in most of these situations there's an element of desperation
right.
in the mother or the parent who has the child, and they're trying to get out of a situation that is desperate, and the child may be in danger. And this isn't going to burden law enforcement. It's what, two in Minnesota, did you say, since we passed it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, you know, we don't know, because this has to be anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that they did say that once some press did find out about something, that they stopped, you know, they stopped them because they didn't want any publicity, you know, so somebody could try to identify this person. And you're very right, Representative Wilkin. These people are desperate. And we just want to make it very easy for them.
I withdraw my amendment. I withdraw my amendment.
Okay. Representative Westerberg.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, maybe I'm just reading more into this than what's really here, but I really have problems with this 2-1 to 2-4. To me, I don't like the way it's written, I guess. I like the idea and the concept, you know. I think what it's trying to accomplish, I think, is the right step to take. But I just want to voice my concerns that I have questions about the way it's worded as far as a parent could be either the mother or father and, you know, and an interested person. I don't know the definition of an interested person, I guess, in this particular situation here. I mean, who that's going to be and what they can actually accomplish here, but I'm just going to leave it at that. I know it's going to civil law, and so I'm sure...
truly wordsmithing. So.
Yeah, and so that ends my comments, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments? Seeing none.
No offense.
I will renew my motion to have House File 3597 be passed and referred to civil law. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Emmer, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning.
Where's this going? Representative Gravelo will move House File 3002 to pass and go to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Before I get started, I just want to praise all of you that have served in this legislature for more than the brief period that I've been so fortunately blessed. What a wonderful experience to have to sit through committee hearings until midnight or 1 o'clock and then drive back to the beautiful country and get up again in the morning and be back here and be all bright and happy and ready to present another wonderful proposal to you folks. House File 3002, some of you, if you've been here long enough, you've seen this type of proposal before. This is simply putting a residency requirement in place for purposes of qualifying for welfare benefits. The bill, it's very basic. I'm not going to read it to you. I'm sure everybody's read it. I just want to read from another portion in law that I believe supports this, and then I'll answer any questions you have, because I'm sure you have some questions about the constitutionality and what are you doing? Hasn't this been addressed before? I'll just read. The legislature, in order to provide these benefits, it creates a risk that persons needing benefits, and specifically medical care, will migrate to the state for primary purpose of obtaining medical care that is subsidized by the state. I believe the next statement is absolutely true, and this is why we need to go down this path. If the state is unable to limit eligibility to legitimate permanent residents of the state faces a significant risk that it will be forced to reduce the eligibility and benefits it would otherwise provide to Minnesotans. That, in a nutshell, is the basis for the residency requirement. This is a very modest requirement. This is a 90-day requirement. Some of you may not be aware that since there are a couple of Supreme Court cases, which we can certainly discuss, there's a Minnesota decision from the early 1990s, but there is also a Wisconsin case recently that has upheld the constitutionality of a 60-day residency requirement. And if you want, we can certainly go in and discuss that. But that is the proposal before you today that I'm asking you to consider, and I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Sloan.
Representative Unger, I'm right with you. I think we adjourned at 11 last night, so I see you quite recently, and then get up and see you again this morning. You asked the question, what is the constitutionality and has this been done before? What is the current number of days that are required for residency? I'm not sure what current law.
Representative Unger.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, for the proposal I'm making, I don't believe there is one, but we have several in statute already. We have I think it's section 256D02, subdivision 12A, which is general assistance, and 256J12, which is MFIP, require applicants to reside in Minnesota for at least 30 days with the intention of making their home here. We do have other residency requirements in place. Obviously, they're shorter than the one that I'm proposing.
Representative Slawick.
Okay, Mr. Chair, so it's 30 days and you're changing it to 90 days?
Yes.
Okay. What about the constitutionality? You talked about there's been several Supreme Court cases, and this would be challenged, obviously.
Well, I've heard, Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, I've heard in our discussions in the Civil Law Committee regularly that you are not an attorney.
Yes.
And I think at times that benefits you to no end. Here, however, please ask me if you need more detail, but this, when you're dealing with constitutional law, if you have looked at this issue, it's been seen as a violation of the right to travel. And it gets reviewed by the courts under a strict scrutiny standard.
Okay.
All right? Because of that, because of the review, they've upheld some more stringent 6-month time period, 1-year time period, they've held those to be unconstitutional. But recently, the Wisconsin court case, and it was Jones versus Milwaukee County, and actually that's a 1992 decision, so it's more than 10 years old. It's early 90s. The 60-day durational residency requirement was upheld on the grounds that the state had a legitimate interest in conserving state funds, and there was no legitimate interest in encouraging and there was a legitimate interest in encouraging employment and preventing fraud, and it didn't impinge upon the right to travel. That was reviewed, if I recall correctly, on a rational basis standard as opposed to the strict scrutiny standard, which I think this would as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
You make a claim that, at least what I understood to be a claim, that people are moving here to get medical assistance and other benefits. Is there a fiscal note on this anywhere to tell us how much it's going to cost to administer and keeping track of people that have been here less than 90 days and people that have been here longer than 90 days? Because is there a large number of these people coming in? Do you have any numbers of or proof that there is a large number of people coming in for this, or is it just gut feel that this is what's going on?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, first, I did not make the statement, as you phrased it, that there are a large number of people coming in to do this. What I told you was I believe it is a legitimate state interest to make sure we maintain the integrity of the programs we have. And I didn't bring this with me, but I had one report last year that indicated, at the risk of drawing the ire of somebody or offending somebody, undocumented persons or illegal immigrants, I don't care, if people that came into the state, pregnant women that accessed benefits in the state and then left. The number that I was given last year was $11 million or something around that figure. I'm not making that statement here. The statement I made to you is that it is a legitimate state interest to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the programs by putting a short residency, durational residency requirement in order to make sure that we don't have that problem. The second part of your question has to do with are there savings? My understanding is, first, there is no fiscal note. Second, my understanding is there would be savings. Third, none have been booked because we do expect that there would be a constitutional challenge.
Is there anything else?
But that, so there's, I guess, so that goes, there hasn't been a fiscal note, so there's no way of knowing if there would be a savings and, or, and what the additional cost for administering two different systems, whether that savings would offset the cost of that, you know, whether it's a wash or, you know, or whether we're just doing something that's going to cost us more money, just, you know, cost $10 to save a dollar.
Mr. Chairman, in the detail that you would like it, Representative Nelson, no. In answer to your question or in response, yes, there would be a savings. Remember that we're simply trying to maintain the integrity of the programs as they exist right now. But I can't give you a detailed number.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, on your fiscal note, you know, I can only follow these fiscal notes so well. It's, you know, it's kind of like balancing my checkbook. But they go out almost 3 or 4 years, don't they?
Mr. Chairman, Emmer. I'm going to be about as direct as you can be here, Representative.
That's always good with me.
After last night, I don't see any other way, and I think it's my approach normally anyway. I don't have a fiscal note in front of me. So if one has been provided to you, I do not have one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have one, but my point was that fiscal notes, I'm going to look at Representative Hackbart, goes out to, I think it's 09, this is 06, that's 3 years out. Would you envision this bill not being implemented for 3 years? And if there's a constitutional challenge to it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would be hopeful that I would get your vote this morning, and then we would be able to present it on the floor eventually, and I would get your vote then, and it would be effective upon enactment. Hopefully, I don't remember what it says, but I would say August, and that no, it would go into effect immediately, and then I just raised for you because we've seen it in the past where there are constitutional challenges. So I'm trying to be on the side of looking at what somebody might do with it. I think it should stand, frankly, and it should there shouldn't be a constitutional challenge. But then what would we have lawyers for?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, it's always nice to get an answer from an attorney that's a non-answer. My question was that if this has got 3 years, 07, 08, 09, that's not counted this year, goes into effect in August, my question was, would you expect if there's a constitutional challenge, it would take less than 3 years or longer than 3 years? And the direct answer would be less than or longer than.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I think I did to answer your question. I'll do it again, and at the risk again of letting my sometimes childish humor impact the message. I have not, as of yet, talked to any Supreme Court justice about what I might do. it was a long night. I'm sorry. I think you're asking me to answer something that I can't give you a specific answer. You're asking me to tell you if there is a challenge, when will it be resolved? I can't give you an answer to that. I would think it would be handled very expeditiously, but again, I can't tell you what the court would do or what the attorneys would do. Or
Representative,
I spent 4 years on civil law, so I had done that 1 o'clock in the morning, leaving and having to listen to everyone, not just have to present and then leave.
But I'm sure there's other questions. I've got a couple for a little later.
Representative Westerberg had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Emmers, I'm just curious on the 90-day limit. How did you come up with that? And, you know, do you think it'll be successful in being challenged? You know, and recognizing you mentioned there was a 60-day provision that was upheld, and I know the 30-day residency requirement. Is that how you get to the 90 days?
Well, that is how we get to the 90 days, and I do think it'll be upheld, yes. And I would almost guarantee it if it's done on a rational basis standard. But again, it kind of like Representative Mahoney, sorry, Representative, I can't guarantee what the court will do. I wouldn't say I can't guarantee.
Thank you.
Representative Slawik, then Nelson, then Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elmer, I was wondering if there's anybody from the department here. I understand that the same proposal came forth last year.
She's coming on down.
Representative Elmer, you didn't carry it last year, did you?
Representative Elmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, even if I had, I doubt I'd remember this morning, but no, I don't think I did.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. I'm Ann Sessoms with the Department of Human Services. Yes, the language in this bill is the same language that was in a bill, a governor's bill last year.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Slavik.
Ms. Sessoms, thanks for letting us know that. Was there any fiscal note on that, or did the department have any figures on what it might cost?
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Slawick, there was no fiscal note last year because there was enough uncertainty about whether or not there would be a court case and whether or not we would actually realize any savings, and so there was no fiscal note.
Representative Slawick.
So I eventually, obviously the language didn't make it through as part of the governor's bill, but so you, at some point it died because, yes, it didn't seem, assumed there'd be a court case and didn't seem pursuable?
Ms. Sessoms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, all I know is it didn't make it into law last year.
Okay. Thank you.
Up to that point, Representative Gravel.
Mr. the testifier, with NFIP being a forecasted program where we don't give a direct appropriation, it's an entitlement, to what degree can we really construct a fiscal note? We're providing a guarantee for a benefit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I can't exactly speak to how the fiscal notes are constructed, but even though it's a forecasted program, it would be reflected if the department estimated that the savings would be realized. And I don't know if Ron can explain it better than that.
Mr. Stoddard,
the savings would be there even in a forecasted program.
Mr. Chairman, MFIP and GA are both forecasted programs, but we do have an appropriation, line appropriation, a direct appropriation for those programs. So if the fiscal note, and there is a fiscal note that has been requested, there is still debate about how to score the bill. The debate is similar to what you're having here. Do you score the bill based on its language, or do you score the bill based on the process? The language being that the bill would have savings as it stands. But the other question that I think we all have to recognize is that there is a potential for a court case, and that may delay or eliminate the possibility of a savings. And I think that's the issue that everyone is faced with. But yes, we would have a reduction in the budget, and then in November, when the forecast, if there was a resolution of the issue, and the issue were to be for a resolution of the issue of this residency requirement in the courts, then the forecast would reflect that resolution.
So, Mr. Chairman, so if the situation changes and we have more people requesting NFIP, we don't give any legislative approval, we just spend more money. And likewise, if the situation were to change, if assuming the Emmer bill were successful, we would just spend less money. There's no legislative involvement in that. We just either spend more or spend less. It's kind of out of our hands.
Well, I don't think it's quite out of the hands of the legislature, because the legislature does directly appropriate the dollar amount for the program. But the direction of the forecast reflects the best estimate of what the demands of the program will be. So,
that's all. Thanks.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. Do you feel that this is going to lead to a court challenge? I mean, you talked about that. Because we're going 90 days. You said Wisconsin's was upheld for 60 days. Do you feel in your heart that this is going to lead to a court challenge, and so then we're putting the state in having to spend money to defend a court challenge?
Mr. Emmer, Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, no, I don't believe in my heart that this will lead to a court challenge, but again, if everyone agreed with me, we wouldn't have any court challenges, and I think we'd have, I mean, I think the world would be a great place to live in, but that's why we're all here, because not everyone agrees with me, and or we have differences of opinion. I can't honestly tell you one way or the other. This is not the six-month durational residency requirement that was introduced some time ago. This is a much lower standard. It's a valid and legitimate state concern. Do I think that people will examine it on both sides of that issue? Yes. When you say in my heart, do I think that I'm welcoming a lawsuit and that I'm going to get thank you cards from constitutional lawyers? No. No.
Representative Nelson.
In my, you know, like I said, if the world agreed with me and my three sons will tell you that we argue a lot about things, that the world would be a better place too if everyone agreed with me too. So I mean, we all have that belief. But my sons would disagree with me on a regular basis. But I guess what I'm getting at here, Wisconsin had a 60-day that was upheld. We're going for a 90-day. If that goes through and gets upheld, do we next bring a bill for 120 days to 180 days, and now we're at the 6 months? I guess that's where I'm coming at here. Are we just setting this up to push that limit a little farther out and a little farther out each time, just kind of push it a little farther down the road?
Mr. Chairman, if I might just quickly respond, because that actually, I know that wasn't as much a question as it was a statement, but I think that's where this discussion really should center, is on what you just raised, Representative Nelson, because the answer or the response to the statement would be no, it shouldn't be 120 and then 180. That issue has been addressed. We are simply trying to put in some form of durational residency requirement that addresses a legitimate state interest, and I'm going to recite from the concurrence of Justice Coyne in the Mitchell versus Steffen case back in 1993, which addressed that six-month durational residency requirement. And you can read the entire thing. I won't bore the committee with that. But she was referencing that particular decision. She said, I consider the Minnesota statute strictly neutral, as it impinges upon the right to travel because a resident newly arrived in Minnesota will be eligible for general assistance in amount, on and on. Then she concludes, at a time when most states are struggling to remain solvent, I can see no earthly reason for limiting a state's option rather than risking financial ruin. So, again, we're at a point in time now, 10-plus years later, where we're faced with the same issues. We want to make sure that we maintain the integrity of our program for the folks, programs for the folks that need them. We don't want to be in the business of turning folks away if they need assistance. In order to do that, I'm proposing a modest residency requirement to help maintain the integrity of those programs. I think if there was at first, I hope there's not a constitutional challenge, but again, you can never say a lawyer won't grab it and run with it. If that happens, I'm confident that it would be upheld.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I fully support your bill, Representative Emmer. I think you're right that it does add another element of integrity to our programs, and it's really important for the people who are paying those bills to have trust and confidence in these programs. And I would also argue, I was involved back when we were trying various options to do something about this residency. It does strike me that as we try to do what's right, particularly when we're seeing new people, whether they're from another state, another nation, wherever it may be, there is a time legitimately of processing to be able to determine that people really, in fact, do meet the standards that we have to get legitimate documentation, to follow back up in terms of time frames, those kinds of things. And I think that could really be argued, and it seems to me it would be a waste of time for anybody to make a constitutional challenge on this, because I believe you could
very well argue that a 90-day period to establish legitimate meeting of requirements is rational.
Okay. Representative Slough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, I just wanted to understand your reasoning on an earlier comment. You said, I think that it cost $11 million for care for pregnant women, that this change would somehow, that wouldn't happen. Can you explain that further?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik. No, actually, I was just pointing out that we're trying to maintain integrity. I said that is not necessarily, in fact, it's not at all related to this. I have another bill that would address that. No, I think you misunderstood what I used that for. I talked about how, I think the question was posed by Representative Nelson, that I had information that we have this flood of folks rushing to the state to access our assistance programs. And my response was, no, I'm trying to put in a legitimate residency requirement to help maintain the integrity of the programs, and I don't have that information that he asked me for, as opposed to the one that you just raised, which I do understand we have that that situation. And I'm sure at some point you'll get to hear another proposal that I have on that separate situation.
Okay, I was just... Mr. Chair, Representative Emery, just, you know, when it comes into to a question about moms getting prenatal or getting care during their pregnancy, I think it's a pretty serious issue. So I'm glad you explained the difference. But you have no statistics at all on who this would, how many people would be affected by this?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Emery.
I don't have any numbers to give you, Representative Slawick, at this time, but as you've already heard, there would be a savings.
That's me. Representative Mahoney.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Emmer, does this have a Senate companion? And where is it in the Senate?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe it does. But that's a great question. As I sit here in front of you, I don't know.
You believe it does have a Senate companion?
I believe it does. But I don't have the answer to your question.
Mr. Chair, could you tell me, did you send the yellow jackets over to a particular senator?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I may have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Does staff know if there's a Senate companion?
Staff can find out and we'll get back to you.
Well, that'd be good. I'm kind of, you know, Representative Emmer, you're generally pretty well prepared for, and this is a compliment, any time you come to the floor or in front of a committee with a bill, so I'm rather surprised at that particular answer. That would, you know, tarnish a little bit your that image, but that's okay. We've all been tarnished around here at one point or another. Here's my real question, and it's actually, I mean, your bill is, you know, it's something that comes up on a regular basis, and you know, we need, as a state, we need to be very careful on the entitlements that we put out. And that we, as a state, and politicians in the state, and decision makers, try to figure out how best to use the dollars that the state has to help residents of the state. But I have to be totally honest here, and I'm glad I'm on record and I'm being recorded, that I'm a bit incensed at one part of your bill. On page 2, starting in line 20 to 25, where you talk about eligible non-citizens. In other words, immigrants from other countries that have gone through the process of applying to this country for residency, looking to become U.S. citizens, and apparently the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, that seems like must be a new name, the INS basically says, we want you to settle in New York City, and they say, you know, they stop in New York City and they see what a delightful town it is to live in, and they get on the next plane or train, and they end up here, and now all of a sudden we're going to punish them for looking for a better life with your bill here. We're saying that we're going to give you the dollars that you would have gotten in the previous state if they have a program like this. I think that's what your bill is doing, and as I'm reading, it's pretty plain language. I just don't think we should hinder people who have really gone through the process, tried to follow the laws of this country in entering this country in this particular fashion. I just want you to explain to me why, and the committee, why you're trying to harm legal immigrants.
Representative Limmer. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, first, let me express my sincere regret at having apparently tarnished my image for you. The one thing that I would respond with is that what you're going to get from me every time is honesty. And I won't just say this time to be perfectly honest. I will always be honest with you. If that meant that I should know where this is in the Senate, again, my apologies, and I'll do my very best to try to resurrect my image for you and anyone else that I may have let down. In answering or in response to your question, I disagree with you about as strongly as I could possibly disagree. And this is why this is a great place to have these debates. I'm not harming anyone with this bill. What I'm trying to do is benefit everyone. Everyone in the state of Minnesota and everyone that is legally in the state of Minnesota who intends to be a resident of the state of Minnesota. I think that's exactly what I was elected to do when I came here. I apologize if it offends someone, if the word police are out there and they're saying that they're supposed to be... folks are supposed to be called this, that, or the other thing. Sometimes I will agree with you that I need to be more sensitive about that. I do not agree, however, that this bill is designed in any way, shape, or form to harm anyone at all. In fact, it's intended to benefit all. So perhaps we just have a disagreement.
Representative Mahoney. No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know why you continually go back to worrying about word police or thought police or whatever. It's never been a worry about mine, and I have a mouth that's worse than yours most often. Just ask my constituents. But I can't understand your logic in saying that you're not harming legal immigrants by saying if North Carolina, Texas, California, Alaska doesn't fit to their hopes and dreams and needs as immigrants to this country, and they find a job, they find a better school for their kids, they find better health care, better anything in the state of Minnesota, and they move here, and they are penalized by saying, you were ordered to go, you are looking for a better life, and you came to Minnesota to enrich our culture and our state with your children, with your knowledge, with your culture, whichever. And we're going to push you back to Alaska, California, Texas, Florida, North Carolina, wherever. It's a philosophical disagreement. I'm not asking for an answer. But I will answer my own question from prior questioning were about the Senate companion, and there's apparently no Senate companion for this particular bill. So probably not going to go anywhere. That's an interesting, will make for an interesting debate. Doesn't, like I say, go anywhere, and hopefully we can maybe get this committee done on time today. Representative Surtich.
I don't know, Representative Mahoney, I have a question, so I'll try to stay fairly brief. I have two kind of areas to ask questions about Representative Member. The first one, I want to go back to the fiscal impact and the fiscal note, since we deal with the money side of this.
troubles me that the department comes down and other folks say, because of the uncertainty of a court case, we haven't figured out the fiscal impact of this. I wish that same sentiment possibly was around when we passed the tobacco tax, because when that happened, there were certain individuals that were predicting a court challenge on that, and we could have maybe then been a little more fiscally prudent. But when we had the tobacco tax, there were fiscal numbers worked out, and we were able to see the impact on that. There's going to be a cost incurred, I'm assuming, by a department by tracking these individuals for the proposed 90 days. I think, court case or not, we should be able to figure out in some ballpark details what that cost would be. And I don't know if this is a question to Representative Emmer or more towards the department, but you think we'd be able to find a certain number there of a cost so that we can balance that with potential savings to the state as well.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, I join in your disappointment. I think that, frankly, we should just be given the savings. I know you're referring to costs, but as it's been related to me, there will be savings.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should be given that savings in numbers, mm-hmm. so I can present that to you. And I think you heard. That's exactly what will happen. There will be savings in the budget. What that number is, it depends on other things. I can't, I'm just like you, I hold an election certificate, I can't tell people how they should, in new language today, how we score it this way or score it that way. Be that as it may, it goes back to Representative Nelson when he asked me about the court challenge. I don't think there should be one. I can't guarantee that there wouldn't be one. I would prefer that I'd have a fiscal impact note that I could show you that here are what the savings are. Without regard to what some lawyer may or may not do in the future.
Yeah.
I can present to you that this would be a savings, and as such, I think it's a very valid and legitimate proposal.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair,
and there's no search.
For all of us, I think it's a dangerous precedent we set when we start saying because a bill before us might be challenged by the court that we can't have the fiscal information we need to make smart and wise decisions as a legislative body. I think that's just not a good excuse, not one that you gave up, Senator Emmer, but just in general, I think that's a poor excuse for our body, because that is just a way, I think a very cute way for the administrative branch to go around our duty of being fiscal watchdogs, whether we want to spend more or less to account for all the money in the state coffers. But I want to get back. Then my other point deals with residency, and this issue strikes me on two accounts. I mean, we have in law right now the 30 days residential requirement. In what I've understood about folks on general assistance, 50% of them have mental health issues or chemical dependency issues, which for those vulnerable citizens, I mean, and that's my what I see them as with those issues, keeping assistance away from them for an additional 60 days, I think, could bring harm to all our communities because of potential outcomes with mental health and chemical dependency issues that could affect us, a cost, if you will, to our communities far beyond their individual lives, but the folks that live around them and their families. So I think by adding those 60 days, there is a different cost that potentially could be incurred by the state because of those issues that they have. And I would just wonder if you could comment on that.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, the only comment I could give you is that I think it would be wrong just to focus on the areas that you have.
Mm-hmm.
It'll have an impact on well beyond that. But I think, again, it's a legitimate interest. We are trying to protect the integrity of the system so that it is available to folks for a long time to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of that, I don't know that you can give me numbers back, you know, specifically the areas that you think it will impact and, you know, the specific result. so we can have this philosophical debate, because that's what it is. Again, I have to come back to, this is a legitimate interest of the state. It's a very rational, low-end requirement, and I would ask you to give it some consideration.
Representative Sturge.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. I do appreciate the philosophical debate, because, I mean, that's, I think, what we do here. And just to bring up the other side, the other state interest in this, I think, is its citizens. And once you hit a 30-day requirement, you're a resident, and I believe you afforded what our state can and will provide. My second concern in this, and it's just come up recently, actually, Representative Rickavina has a constituent dealing with a homestead resident issue. He's in the military, and he's having trouble. This is not in this committee, but I could see it coming back to play here. He's bought a house and then got shipped off overseas. He can't get his residency requirement for homestead because he's serving in Iraq. And so I'm almost seeing a lot of these issues like yours before us through a different prism, because We're in a time of war now, of military personnel both leaving the state in whatever circumstance, but then coming back. Some of these individuals, and like I said, half the people that get GA have certain barriers, and some of these barriers happen because young men and women go to war and don't come back the same person, as unfortunate as that is. My fear is, in building up residency requirements beyond, this potentially could be hurting some of those same veterans that are coming back to the states, and they come back sometimes to Mississippi or wherever they're shipped out and want to move to Minnesota because one of their buddies that they served with is from Minnesota and such, and I think they're delaying, once again, our state assistance, and that would be not in the best state interest for these Minnesotans that would be coming to the state. So I'd just like your comments on that as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first you bring into play, I mean, there are other benefits offered through the military.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think you're mixing apples and oranges, with all due respect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is going to impact the situation that you raised. Now, if you've got a specific example, you're right. I'm asking you to consider passing a proposal that puts a durational residency requirement on the qualification for benefits. The example that you gave of one of our soldiers going to war, coming back home, it ignores the fact that that soldier has access to benefits through other sources. But I'd be happy to sit down with you after today and go over whatever specific circumstances you have.
Representative Gravel, to that point.
Well, to Mr. Chairman, to a previous point that Representative Sturge made, and my understanding from reading the statutes last year was that I believe there are current exceptions. There are exceptions to the 30-day requirement currently in law. And maybe Chairman Bradley or Representative Wilkin could offer some insight on that, but I'm pretty sure about that there are statutory exceptions where we waive the 30-day guideline right now. And as I read Representative Emmer's bill before us, I don't think he waives any of those exceptions, and the exceptions that would apply to the 30-day requirement would still apply to a 90-day requirement if that were enacted.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, I don't know, this might be for the department, but maybe I didn't hear this correctly, but I think, Ms. Sessions, when you spoke, you said it wasn't that you were going to project cost savings, you projected there were no cost savings. Is that correct?
Ms. Sessions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, you're correct that last year there was no fiscal note, there were no savings and no costs projected.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Sessions, so are you saying then the work wasn't completed, or there are no cost savings projected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, the decision was made that based on the uncertainty of implementing because of the record of litigation that we would not project that there would be savings associated with reduced benefits for the two cash groups that are included in this bill.
Representative Slawick.
So, Representative Emmer, I think your premise is there's going to be cost savings, and we're hearing from the department there isn't, right?
Mr. Chairman, I disagree with your interpretation. We're now going, we're taking the words and turning them around. As you've heard this morning, and perhaps you and I hear it differently, but as you've heard this morning, there was a decision made not to score it, I think, were the words that Mr. Soderberg used earlier, because of the uncertainties. And frankly, I heard earlier the statement that Mr. Soderberg made that there would be savings. There would be a reduction in the budget. But
Representative Sloan.
Department, I don't know if you can go on record with this, but do you see that there would be cost savings?
Ms. Sessions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, if it were implemented and it were not challenged in court and went into effect, there are individuals and cases that would receive reduced benefits. The fiscal note was done without the savings because of the history of litigation and the uncertainty of whether or not we would be able to implement it and it would go into effect.
Representative Search.
Thank you. And I just want to reiterate this one more time. Ms. Sessions, this isn't for you. I mean, this is for any person from the administration. There's no guarantee that any bill before us. We had fiscal notes on bills today that, you know, God bless Representative Finstad. He probably hopes it passes. But there's no certainty that that bill's going to pass, yet we have a fiscal note in front of us. I mean, why pick and choose which bills with fiscal notes based on the administration's opinion that it's going to pass or be challenged or any of the like? Can somebody answer me that question? Maybe not today, but I mean,
Chairman, I don't. Maybe my earlier comments were misunderstood. The discussion that's being held here is exactly the discussion as to how to score this bill. Should we consider the bill as it stands and the language if it were to be implemented, or should we consider what may happen if the bill is passed? And that is the discussion, and we haven't. I think everybody is sensitive to both sides of this issue, but I think your point is well taken, Representative.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Mr. Soderberg, is there a way that we can see how much we would save with the language as it stands? That's predictable. That is something we have. We don't know whether it is a court case or not.
Mr. Soderberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think that you could make a request to the department to show you that how much it would save if the bill were to be implemented and do it. And I think that is a very legitimate thing, and I think that's an appropriate question. This, in all my time, I have yet to have an issue that is as difficult to deal with. But I think I'm becoming more and more resolved to a particular way that I think we should deal with it, as opposed to trying to project the future.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Chair. I've been through this so many times that I think you actually have the right idea, because I think we're perfectly capable, I think, as legislators to be allowed to look at what the potential savings might be, notwithstanding whatever it may be. And I run into it constantly when we have language that says we have to seek a federal waiver. And then there's a kind of a probability established that maybe it will, maybe it won't, and depend upon kind of a subjective judgment, we're either given a fiscal note or not. And it's similar to this. I mean, you have to probably agree that there's some probability involved in this thing, and someone's making a judgment that it might not happen. Therefore, we can't book the savings, but we sure as heck ought to be able to look at the potential savings. And then we as legislators can sort of make our own mind up about what it is. But that's, I understand the logic from the department. There is some legitimacy to, if you actually book it in the budget, and there's a very low probability of actually being able to make it happen for whatever the reason might be, you put your budget at risk. That's kind of what this amounts to. But it leaves us absent some good information to have the legitimate numbers discussion, and I think there's a way to do that.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that goes, and it is to Ms. Sessions or to Ron, but the question I have, if you looked at this and you projected savings, then you must have an idea of what kind of numbers we're talking about, the number of people that we're going to be saving money, that should equate to the number of caseload cases we're going to have. They should be able to see those numbers or have an idea of what those numbers are. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at is, how many are there? Is there a large number or is it a small number of cases that we're saying that this would affect this number of people?
Ms. Sessoms.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our estimates last year were that if this went into effect, that the number of diversionary work program families that would be affected per month would be 422, and that the number of GA, general assistance cases without children, would be 274.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
That's out of a total number, you know, that's a number, but how out of a total number of cases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, I don't have the number of applications per month because it's a subset of applications per month, not of the entire caseload. I don't have the caseload number either, sorry.
Okay. Well, so then we can, you know, because 200, if it's 400 out of 800, that's 50%, but if it's 400 out of 4,000, you know, that's a lot smaller percentage. And I guess that's what I'm, you know, to judge what we're arguing here about.
I think we got an answer walking down.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand there are, for general assistance, there are 14,000 active cases in a month, but that isn't the 200 or whatever number that I gave you, is not a... I mean, it's a subset of that, but it's really applications per month, and I don't have that number. We can get it to the committee for both diversionary work and general assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Very good discussion.
You made a motion.
You did.
I did. Representative Bravo renews his motion to have House File 3002. Be passed and referred to Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No. No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we get the minutes of March 23rd. Representative Mahoney has read them and thoroughly understands them and moves their passage. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. We're adjourned.